Okay, let me remind you where we are at, all right? And tonight I want you to settle in to this period, okay? We are at the end of the medieval age, okay? So we are ending the medieval period of the church and moving into the next period of the church, which we call, of course, the Reformation. But as we approach the 16th century, as we approach the beginnings of the Reformation, there's a short window of time just before that that is very important for us to understand. And tonight I have entitled this particular lecture the Beginnings of the Reformation. You could call it the Pre-Reformation. And we want to take a look at this because it's very important to our understanding of what's going to come next. I pointed out last week that the 13th century is the high point of the medieval Catholic Church. The papacy reaches its zenith of power, but in the midst of that comes a great schism in the leadership of the Western Church. Although the papacy reaches great power, with that great power comes, of course, a great struggle for that power. And there's a division in which you find two different factions of the church in the West. You have popes residing in the south of France, in Avignon, and then you have popes, of course, in Rome. For a period of time, just prior to this, the papacy moved entirely to Avignon and became a puppet of the French aristocracy, but a reform movement, quote-unquote, arose in order to try to restore the papacy to its proper Roman place, and so new popes arose in Rome, thus you wind up with a schism where you now have two popes, one in Avignon claiming to be the proper pope and another in Rome claiming to be the proper pope, and the two popes are excommunicating each other and putting each other under indictment and so on, and you have a big problem. When the popes are in Avignon, you call it the Babylonian captivity of the papacy, and then when you have this great split, you have what is commonly referred to as the Great Schism of the West. But in the midst of all this, we must not forget that the church, the Western church, has embraced certain ecclesiastical practices that are evil. We've talked about some of these in the past, but they are very much at the height of their involvement in the church. They're very much at the very core of the church at this time. One of them is called simony, which is the idea of purchasing an ecclesiastical position, buying a bishopric, for example, or something to that effect. Simony is all over the place in the Catholic Church at this time. You've got nepotism, you've got absenteeism, which is priests and bishops that are taking a paycheck, but they're not doing their job. They're not there. They're drawing monies, but they're not actually doing the job. And you've got pluralism in the church. You've got all kinds of evils that have infected the Western church at this point. I mean, look, we're 1,500 years after Christ at this point, and human beings do not tend towards orthodoxy. They tend towards heterodoxy. And so it's perfectly reasonable that now 15 centuries after the church begins, you would have a church deeply flawed and corrupt. Not only has the church embraced ecclesiastical practices that are evil, but it's also embraced certain dogmatic positions that are inconsistent with the gospel. We've talked about, for example, the church by this point has embraced fully transubstantiation, the belief that the elements become the actual body and blood of Christ in the Mass. You have clerical celibacy, which is now considered to be dogmatic in the church. You've got sacerdotalism, confession being one of the sacraments where men come and confess their sins to a priest and receive absolution. All of these kinds of things, most of which were put forth and dogmatized by the Fourth Lateran Council, are now very much at the heart of the Catholic Church. So what you have at this point is you have an ecclesiological mess and you have a theological mess in the West. You have a massively corrupt church on both sides of the equation. And so it is into this world that some early reform movements begin. Now, we've already talked about a couple of them. You remember a few weeks ago we talked about the mendicant orders, when you have the various, we have men coming out of the monasteries who take vows of poverty and go and preach the gospel as men of poverty. St. Francis of Assisi, for example, was in an attempt to reform the church and bring the true gospel back. They would repudiate money and so forth. That didn't last very long, but it was one of those kinds of things. Scholasticism, we talked about this, of men who rose up and attempted to recover some theological orthodoxy by injecting rationalism into the discussion, by making logical arguments of what is believed and so forth. So there were some early attempts at reform, but now in the 14th into the 15th century rises some early attempts at true ecclesiastical and theological reform. What we're going to be talking about tonight is the early reformers and the pre-Reformation period. In other words, what I want to talk about tonight is a period of time that really could be described as the true beginning of the Reformation. Men before Luther who began to teach and preach a return to Orthodox Christian doctrine. We like to think in Reformed circles of the Reformation beginning in 1517 with Luther, but I want to make a strong argument tonight that the Reformation actually began 100 years earlier. Okay? And so, follow with me. There are three specific things I want to talk about tonight. I want to talk first about a movement, and then I want to talk about two men that are intertwined with this movement. Okay? And this movement is called the Conciliar Movement, C-O-N-C-I-L-I-A-R. Comes out of the word conciliation, the Conciliar Movement. Now, during the Babylonian captivity, when the popes were only in Avignon, they had abandoned Rome and gone to the south of France, and in the subsequent Great Schism, when you had two rival popes together, the world sat there and said, how do we solve this? How do we solve this problem? How do we get to a place where we can bring these two together into a single papacy and a single ecclesiastical leadership again? How do we get to that place? I mean, the two men don't agree, and they never will. So how do we do that? And so there were many who hoped that the church would be able to do what it had done in the early years of the church, particularly during the imperial church, of resolving conflicts in the church by calling a council. An ecumenical council in which bishops from all over the church, from every aspect of the church, would come together and put their heads together and come up with a way of solving this particular issue. You know, like Nicaea and Constantinople, when they had to deal with the issues of the nature of God, and then in Constantinople dealing with the nature of Christ. Is he fully God? Is he fully man? How does that work? Etc. Great councils came together and made decisions. The bishops came together and they made these, they eventually were led by God to bring forth orthodoxy. Well, that's the exact same hope at this point. And this hope began to grow in this period of time. Since the popes themselves couldn't solve the issue, maybe a council from the whole church could gather to sort out the issue and bring leadership back to stability and singleness. So the conciliar movement was born. There was, during the late 14th and early 15th centuries, a rising belief within the church in the West that it was time to reconcile the leadership, to use conciliation. Conciliation is the dispute resolution process by which you use a conciliator, someone who acts as a go-between between two parties to formulate a single solution to their two opposite demands. Okay, very much like Christ being a mediator between us and God. He is holy, we are absolutely unholy. Christ becomes a mediator between the two of us. That's the same basic idea. That's the same picture. Can we bring a conciliation together? Can we bring a council together? It was built around the belief, the rising belief in this day, that the universal church held authority over the Pope, not the other way around. The popes themselves, of course, believed that they had absolute authority, not only over the church and over its ecclesiastical hierarchy, but many of them even over the emperors in the various places in the rising nationalism that was coming up in Europe at the time. They actually believed that they were in charge and that they could control these men. They did, in many cases, as we pointed out last week. But there was a rising movement in this period of time to come to believe that, no, the Pope answers to the Church, not the other way around. The Church is ultimately authority of Christ on earth, not the Pope himself. The belief was that the popes needed to submit themselves to a council that would settle the dispute and bring healing and restoration to the leadership. Now, you will notice that this is an important Reformation tenet, is it not? This will become key to the Reformation with a capital R that will start at through this period of time. That a key tenet is that the Church is the universal authority, not the Pope. Probably the best example I could give you is to go read the 1689 Confession, the original Baptist Confession, and you will see that there's a number of cases where the divines writing that confession will call out the Pope for being in error. And they will stand and say he is not in charge of the Church. And there's a number of cases in there where they will particularly repudiate the authority of the Pope. It's beginning already here. 100 years, in this case, almost 200 years earlier, there's already a movement rising up in the West to see the Church as being more important than the Pope. The belief that a singular ecclesiastical leader cannot, by definition, be the head of the universal Church of Christ. Only Christ can be head of the Church. That's fundamental, right? It's fundamental to Pauline theology. Therefore, it must be fundamental to the Church. It's completely upside down by this point, 15 centuries in. But nonetheless, it is starting to rise back up again. So you're already starting to smell the flowers of Reformation beginning at this time. They're already starting to bud, and you're seeing them come. Now, obviously the question becomes, who can call this council? Okay, so if there's a council that needs to be called, who can call it? I mean, after all, if one side calls the council, how's the other side going to react to whatever decision it makes? Well, it's going to say, I'm sorry, the council's invalid because we didn't call it. They called it, and they're not qualified because we're the true pope over here, or I'm the true pope over here, and so only I can call the council, so they're counting. So this is the problem. But here's what ultimately happened. Right about the turn of the 15th century, as you cross into the 1400s, the cardinals, and by the way, by this time, leading bishops in the Church were starting to be called cardinals. Okay, that term appears, we're not exactly sure from where, and it's almost as though it appears out of nowhere. These bishops, who start to become the most premier bishops in the Church, the cardinals, gather together from both sides and issue a joint call to a great council. And this first great council is called to be held in the city of Pisa in Italy in 1409. So right about the beginning of the 15th century. Now, in response to Pisa, or the cardinals from both sides calling this council, of course, both popes decided immediately to call their own council. All right, so they decided, nope, not going to go to that one, but we'll call our own. So the guy in Avignon calls his, and the guy in Rome calls his. Well, nobody showed up at the two rival councils, and so that pretty much disappeared. The council that was called then, which met at Pisa in 1409, its first problem is, okay, which of these two men is the valid successor of Peter? Who is the valid vicar of Christ for the Church at this point? That's obviously the fundamental question. How do you solve that problem? The simple answer is neither. And so the council immediately deposed both popes, declared both of them to be no longer valid, and elected one of their own. They elected Alexander V to become the singular pope, replacing both of their rivals. So their first and primary action was to immediately declare that both popes were invalid. Here's the right guy. We've elected Alexander V. He now represents the universal Catholic Church. All right. Now, the council then took some measures against simony and other evils. They didn't get very far, and then it adjourned shortly thereafter. So its fundamental intention was to solve the schism by coming together, declaring both popes to be invalid, and to raise another. Okay. What is the result of that? Now you have three popes. Okay? So the Council of Pisa didn't make it any better. They actually made it worse, because the two men who believed they were the rightful heir to the papacy both obviously shunned Alexander V, and so now you have three popes. But because this conciliar movement was having profound effects on the thinking in Europe, most of the nobility in Europe actually embraced Alexander V as the true pope. Most of the nobility in Europe realized that this schism cannot go on forever, and many of them, with wiser heads prevailing, decided, you know what, we should embrace the new guy that's been put. And so the two rival popes found themselves with little support after this council. They still had enough support to continue in their positions, but it was clearly waning through time. The problem comes when Alexander V dies, and he dies less than a year after he is elected to the position, and the cardinals then of the council, by the way, the council adjourned, but it rejoined itself, elected after that a man by the name of, or who took the name, John XXIII. Now, at this particular time, as you know, the Hundred Years' War was going on, and there was a great deal of turmoil going on in Europe, and so John XXIII, with great political turmoil all swirling all around him, he was forced to flee to Germany under the protection of Emperor Sigismund. And that's where he was. Now, just as an aside, some who may be familiar with Christian, some who may be familiar with the history of the 20th century, may be surprised when I say that there was a pope by the name of John XXIII. And the reason why is because there was another John XXIII elected in 1958. He was pope when I was born in 1960. He died in 1963. He is the pope who called what is commonly referred to as the Second Vatican Council. You may be familiar with the Second Vatican Council. One of the chief things that happened at the Second Vatican Council was they decided that the Mass no longer needed to be in Latin, and that the priest didn't have to face away from the congregation anymore. He could speak in the vernacular of the people to the people. That was a significant change in the Mass, which I grew up under. I was only 3 years old when it occurred, but as I grew into my teenage years, I was only familiar with the Mass in English. It was John XXIII who had invoked this particular council. The Roman Church, the Church today, only accepts the successors of the Pope who was in Rome during this great schism, Urban VI. I mentioned him last week. He was the Pope in the great schism on the Roman side, and the current Roman Church only accepts the popes running through that line. So John XXIII, established as the one in this conciliar movement by this council, was rejected by the Catholic Church. And so the next guy who decided to take the name John assumed that the next John in line was 23rd, even though in reality he really was 24. By the way, in my lifetime, there have been six popes. John the 23rd, then Pope Paul VI, who was the pope during most of my formative years in the Catholic Church. And then he was succeeded by John Paul I, who took the name of the previous two popes, John and Paul, in order to honor them. But you remember, he only lasted 33 days and had a heart attack and died. So his successor, John Paul II, became pope after him, which is the most famous of the popes that you're probably familiar with in your own lifetime. He was then followed by Benedict XVI, who continued until 2005 when he resigned from his position, and then was followed by a guy by the name of Francis, who's the current pope, otherwise known as Francis I. Okay? So in my lifetime, there's been those popes. It took me a few minutes to remember them, but I got them all. I got them all. Okay, so Alexander dies. John XXIII is elected by the conciliar council. He is forced to flee away because of political turmoil. which then forced something to occur. Emperor Sigismund of Germany said to John the 23rd, "I will support you and I will protect you while you're here in Germany, but only if you will convene another council to continue fixing this great schism, because it's obviously not fixed yet." Now, the real reason is probably because Emperor Sigismund disliked John the 23rd and disagreed with his lifestyle, but we don't know that for sure. So John the 23rd invoked another conciliary council. It met at Constance in 1414. Now, this one, the Council of Constance, is the key council of this conciliar movement. Okay, the Council of Pisa started it, but Constance is the one that really matters. John assumed that the council would support him as pope, right? I mean, after all, he called the council. The emperor said that he would have the protection of, he would give protection to him, so John assumed that he would be supported, but the council said no. And he fled. They wanted his resignation, and he fled. And he went and hid for a while, for a few months. He was eventually captured. He was taken back to Constance, all this in 1414. He was forced to resign. And then they stuck him in prison for the rest of his life, because they didn't want him making a claim to the papacy again. The council then, after this, enacted a few decrees for reformation. Hold that thought. And they elected Martin V. to replace John the 23rd. By this point, then, the two rival popes, the one in Avignon and the one in Rome, see the handwriting on the wall. And they recognize that their days of continuing to claim to be the pope are coming to an end. Gregory the 12th, who was the Roman pope, the one the current Catholic Church accepts as the correct pope, he actually resigns his position. Benedict the 13th, the last Avignon pope, the one in France, fled from his position because he had a sneaking suspicion they were coming for him too. So he fled, disappeared. And so at this point, in 1414, the split papacy comes to an end. At this point, you have one pope. His name is Martin V. Now, if you look at, as I said, Catholic history doesn't see it this way. The way Catholics would see this is that Gregory the 12th, who was the Roman pope, that they acknowledge is the rightful pope, Martin V is not, and all of those that came before George the 12th in Rome would actually be the valid popes. So they ignore the conciliar movement entirely today. But it happened. You can't get around it. It did solve the great schism of this time. Now, after Martin was established, there were a number of other councils that followed. There was one in Pavia, which moved to Siena in 1423. It wasn't unimpressive. There was another at Basel in 1430, also called by Martin V. He died when it began, so Eugene IV continued it after him. At this particular point now, with these new councils coming, it seems to the world as though these councils have managed to flip the power of the papacy to themselves, and that the councils have become more important than the pope. Because after all, they're the ones now declaring who's the pope, right? Because we had Alexander V, then we had John the 23rd, then we had Martin V, now we have Eugene IV, all being called by these councils. And so the popes are getting the very real impression at this point that the councils are more important than them, which is exactly what the conciliar movement wanted to happen. They wanted to wrest the power from the pope and put it back into the church, into these councils. But the result was that the councils themselves eventually disbanded, with a singular pope now in place in Rome, and guess what happens? Everything goes back to him thinking of himself as the chief guy. Once the councils stop meeting by around 1430, about 16, 17 years later, the result is that the guy they have put on the seat of Peter in Rome now comes to see himself as the pope again. So in reality, nothing really changes with the conciliar movement. Now, The conciliar movement itself was able to effect some ecclesiastical reconciliation. It was able to end the Great Schism, okay? No more two popes, now just one. He's back in Rome. And so, in a sense, the conciliar movement did, in fact, reform the church ecclesiastically by getting this power struggle to end and bring the church back to one leader and one hierarchy, etc. But the real enemy of the church remained. The real enemy is its doctrinal error flowing out of this ecclesiastical structure. Yes, it may be true that the Great Schism ends, and now we have only one pope sitting on the throne, or sitting on the seat of Peter, but the doctrinal issues that the pope embraces and the traditions of the church have not changed. In fact, the conciliar movement, as a part of its work to reestablish a proper ecclesiastical hierarchy, actually attempts to keep those traditions in place, to enforce those conditions over the church as a part of solving the schism. Now that's important because it leads us to the two men who are involved in this conciliar movement. And the first of these men is a man by the name of John Wycliffe. John Wycliffe lived from 1330 to 1384. Now, if you notice those dates, 1330 to 1384, this is before the conciliar movement, okay? This is before the days of this movement. Because remember, the conciliar movement was really around the end of the 15th century as you get into the 16th century, and so he's living 70 years earlier than that, 70 to 80 years earlier than that. But he's important in the midst of this conciliar movement. Now, we don't know much about his early years. He is named after the Yorkshire village from which he was born. Wycliffe-on-Tees was the name of the village. He lived during the Avignon papacy. In other words, he lived during the Babylonian captivity. He lived during the days when there were only popes in France, even before a new pope arose in Rome and caused the Great Schism. So he's living early in all of this controversy. Wycliffe studied at Oxford. He went to Oxford at the age of 15 in 1345. He was famous for his logic, but he had no sense of humor. He left Oxford to serve the crown. He went to serve the king, first as a diplomat and later as a polemicist, meaning that he went to defend certain things that the king believed to be true. Okay? Keep that in mind. In 1362, while he was at Oxford, English became the language of the courts. Up until that time, Norman French was spoken in the courts. So the king and his court spoke Norman French. Remember, there was always a close relationship between the English and the French. There was, I mean, where are we at? We're in the middle of the Hundred Years' War, right? Okay, between the English and the French. And so the English language became the language of the courts. It had already become the vernacular language of the people. But it's now being embraced by the courts themselves. And so it's becoming the official language of England at this time. All right? So it's important that you keep that in mind. While Wycliffe was alive, he penned two works on the limits of lordship. Okay, remember I said he was a polemist. He argued for positions. That's what polemists do. He wrote two works, one called On Divine Dominion and the other On Civil Dominion. You can see where the two works go. On Divine Dominion is going to have to do with ecclesiastical offices in terms of what they can control and do, and On Civil Dominion, what the king and his courts can do. And so Wycliffe writes on these two issues. These works were instrumental in helping the English authorities, the English courts, to deal with papal influence. Because there was a great deal of rejection against the Pope being in charge of the English Empire and telling the king what to do. Okay, you will notice how this all feeds together. There's a movement going on in the world at this time that the Pope's power needs to be limited, because up until this time his power had been almost unlimited. He could tell any king anywhere what to do under threat of excommunication and hell, literally. And that king would be forced to obey him in order to not find himself in hell. And so these popes were wielding enormous authority. The rise of nationalism, which I talked about in last week's lesson, was beginning all over the continent, where each of these areas was starting to develop their own little kingdoms. England being no different from the rest, attempting to establish itself as its own nation with its own borders, its own language, its own economy, its own authorities, and so on, and wrest itself from underneath the papal authority. And so Wycliffe's works as a polemist were used by the authorities to try to wrest this authority. They made, what Wycliffe made was excellent arguments over how much power a pope is really allowed to have. Specifically, what Wycliffe argued in his works is that all legitimate dominion comes from God, and only from God, and is pictured primarily in serving others. Not in being served, but in serving others. And Wycliffe appealed to Christ as the example, who came not to serve, not to be served, but to serve. In other words, Wycliffe argued that any ecclesiastical authority, say a church like the Catholic Church, that imposed taxes for its own benefit or extends its power beyond the spiritual realm is illegitimate. It is not the true church. Civil authorities that press too far are also illegitimate. On civil dominion, on divine dominion. Now, he was given the reward for his help of the civil authorities in dealing with Rome. He was given, as a reward, the parish of Lutterworth, which he pastored until his death. The city of Lutterworth. He was given the parish. He was given the bishopric, if you will, to preach in Lutterworth, and he stayed there until his death. By the way, that would haunt him, that he was given that as a reward. Okay, hold that thought. Now, as he was preaching in Lutterworth, Wycliffe grew even more radical in his view of authority. When I say radical, it ain't radical from our perspective, but it was from that particular day. He argued that the true church is not the pope and his hierarchy, but the invisible body of those who are predestined to salvation. Where do you think he got that from? He got that from Augustine. He was a fan of Augustine's writings, and as he read Augustine, he found this idea to be the case. The fruits of the elect demonstrate who they are. We know who the elect are by virtue of how they act. And because so many of the church leaders act the way they do, they clearly are reprobate. Wycliffe also argued, not only did he argue that the entire true church is not the pope, but just the elect, he also argued that Scripture is the possession of the church, and only the church can interpret the Bible correctly. Now, what it means by that is not what Catholics mean today. What Catholics mean today is, that's right, the church is the repository of Scripture and only the church can interpret it. No, because Wycliffe's definition of the church was not the ecclesiastical hierarchy, but the elect, the people. So Wycliffe says it's not the official church that owns the Bible, but it's the invisible church that owns the Bible. It's the people who own the Bible. Which is what precipitated Wycliffe to begin translating the Latin Vulgate into English. Because what he wanted to do was give the Bible back to the people. By the 15th century, no one could read Latin except the priests, and them not even all. Many of them were incapable of even reading the Latin Vulgate themselves. Latin, by the 15th century, was a dead language. And so what you have is you have a Bible that nobody can read, including even the priests themselves in many cases who can't read it. And so what did Wycliffe do? He set about, with his Oxford-trained education, and remember, Latin was the language of education, and so much of the education that he had learned had been in Latin, and so he was able to take out a Latin Vulgate and begin to translate it into English, which is why the Wycliffe Bible Society is based on his work. Because he began. He didn't finish it, unfortunately. He died before it was finished, but his followers, his successors, did finish it. If the Bible belonged to the true church, then it needed to be readable by the true church. Wycliffe was most controversial, however, in his understanding of the Lord's Supper. He wrote a tract called On the Eucharist, and in it he rejected transubstantiation. As the denial, now get this, as a denial of the incarnation. One of the best arguments I've ever heard against transubstantiation is this one. When God joined with humanity, the humanity was not destroyed. No, in fact, both were present. Correct? Is this not what Constantinople argued? When the Son of God entered into human flesh, the human flesh was not destroyed, was it? No, in fact, what was there was both the flesh and the divine, the human and the divine. So Wycliffe argues very simply that in a mysterious sort of way, both the body of Christ, His presence, and the bread are both there. Transubstantiation says the bread becomes the flesh of Christ and thus is no longer bread. In transubstantiation, the Catholic Church teaches that when they hand you the host and they say the body of Christ, and you say amen to that, what you are admitting is that the thing the priest is about to put on your tongue is the very flesh of Christ himself. It is not bread. It is the flesh of Christ. That's transubstantiation. Wycliffe says no. They're both present there. Now, Luther and Zwingli had this argument over this issue about 150 years later. But it's already begun. That is, you will notice the early nature of the Baptist distinctives in the supper being present here in Wycliffe. Because when we come to the table, we don't believe that the elements become anything other than bread and whatever, grape juice or wine, right? We don't believe the elements change. We do believe that Christ is present, if you will, in a mystical sort of way, mysterious sort of way, He's present, but we don't believe the elements change. Notice Wycliffe was already there in the early 1300s, or middle 1300s. Now, how do you think the church received this? He was immediately declared a heretic by the papacy. Gregory the Eleventh issued 5 bulls against him, sent to various places, including the various universities that he had been at, and he was declared a heretic by many. There was a peasant revolt that came up in 1381. When he supported it, because he agreed with many of the principles of the peasants, he was accused of instigating it and was summoned to appear before Archbishop Courtney. 10 of his tenets, including the ones that I mentioned just a moment ago, were declared heretical. His writings were placed under ban, meaning they are not to be read by anyone. And the archbishop pressured many of his followers to recant, many of whom did. When he died in 1384, he died of a stroke, by the way. When he died in 1384, because he was a priest and because he was still in good standing in the church, he had been declared a heretic, but he had not been removed from his position because of the power of the emperor to prevent it. He was buried in consecrated ground. They put him in a consecrated cemetery. But the Council of Constance, remember I mentioned it a few minutes ago, as the central council of the conciliar movement in 1414, condemned him as a heretic, disinterred his remains, burned them, and threw them into the Swift River. As a statement to the world at the time that they were attempting to hold fast to the traditional dogmas of the church. Remember I said a minute ago, in their attempt to keep the, in order to fix the Great Schism, their attempt was to keep the traditions of the church in place. Let's fix the papacy, but let's hold fast what the church is. And then their zeal to do so, they condemned Wycliffe, who, some 30, 40 years earlier, had made these kinds of statements against the church. They dug him up, burned him, and threw his, what was left of him in the river. They did it as a statement against what they saw as heresy. The Lollards continue to teach Wycliffe's doctrines, translate Scripture, and preach a more reformed view of the Christian faith from him. They continue to teach, as he had started, that the Bible is for the people, the pastor should not hold civil office, the worship of images and pilgrims is evil, clerical celibacy is unbiblical, etc. The Lollards continued his work. Now, Wycliffe's work underpinned a new movement that would arise within the church, which would flower into the full Protestant Reformation over similar reasonings. So let me ask you a question. Was Wycliffe actually the father of the Reformation over Luther? And almost 200 years earlier? And I would say, yeah. If we're going to be fair, Wycliffe already planted the seeds of what would become the various fundamental realities of the Reformation. He was already preaching and teaching in the 1380s what became fundamental teachings of the Reformation. That the Bible belongs to you and I, and that it should be preached, and that salvation is by faith alone, and so it goes. He was already beginning the seeds of the Reformation. The one difference is that Luther would take up the specific issue of sola fide, of salvation by grace alone through faith alone. That's not fundamental in Wycliffe's writings. But that doesn't imply that Wycliffe didn't open the door to that. I would say that Luther comes out of the tradition of a Wycliffe who started this idea. And the movement began long before Luther even got to that point. In fact, it has been suggested by some that Luther was actually influenced by Wycliffe's teachings. Which leads us to a second man. So you'll understand why I'm going there. There's a second man that goes along with that, and that's a man by the name of John Huss. Now, John Huss lived from 1362 to 1450. So you'll notice he lives right in the days of the conciliar movement. Wycliffe lived before the conciliar movement, such that the Council of Constance dug up his bones and burned him, okay? But Huss lives right in the days of the conciliar movement. Now, Huss was from Bohemia. Bohemia is in the Czech Republic. He was a student at the University of Prague. While he was there, as a good Catholic, he used most of his funds to purchase something called a plenary indulgence. A plenary indulgence is a purchase from the priest of forgiveness of your sins that would free you from the effect of those sins in purgatory. You would buy an indulgence in order to get you out of purgatory for a while. Okay? So he had used his money while he was at the university to buy a plenary indulgence. That would come back to haunt him. He eventually rose to the position of Dean of Faculty and Philosophy there at the University of Prague, and he was appointed preacher at the Chapel of Bethlehem, which was a center for preaching in the vernacular, in the language of the people. Okay? Now, why is that? And the reason is because Huss had come across Wycliffe's teachings. In fact, Wycliffe's teachings had come to Bohemia through a political connection. King Richard II of England was married to a Bohemian princess. And so the connection between the two lands eventually brought Wycliffe's teachings to Bohemia, to the Czech Republic. And Huss became familiar with them. Now, he agreed with almost everything of Wycliffe except Wycliffe's view on transubstantiation. That issue is secondary to our discussion here. But he did agree with so much of Wycliffe's teaching. And in fact, the coming of Wycliffe's teaching into Bohemia caused a great uproar in the universities, because it started there. would start in the universities where men would get together and debate these things, and eventually the universities in Bohemia split. And there were a number of those who disagreed with Wycliffe and moved to Leipzig in Germany and started their own university. This great debate regarded the heretical nature some considered Wycliffe. But, in general, the Czechs agreed with Wycliffe. They agreed with him that the Bible belongs to the people, that it should be preached in the language of the people, that the hierarchy of the church does not run the universal church. The universal church is over the Pope, and the Pope answers to the elect, and so on. All of Wycliffe's ideas had come to Bohemia. You will notice that this is at the beginning of the 15th century. So Huss's early preaching in this chapel for preaching in the vernacular, which is how it came to be that way, Wycliffe's teachings that the Bible should be present in the language of the people, influenced this particular chapel that Huss had been sent to, and so he began to preach there in the vernacular of the people. And so during the days of this conciliatory movement, Huss's early preaching was simply to continue what the conciliarists were advocating. Let's not abandon the traditional teachings of the church. It's not our goal. Let's continue to believe what we have believed in our traditions down through the last 15 centuries. But let's restore the ecclesiastical order. Let's fix this great schism. Let's fix this reality that we have popes in France and popes in Rome and now popes in Pisa, in Italy, somewhere else, and we got all this problem. Let's solve that particular problem. So his early teaching was that. But he decided to wade into the issue of the corruption of the clergy because he saw the corruption of the clergy. So many others did as well, but he was preaching about it. In fact, he called this corruption the Lord's fat ones. Now, you remember Alexander V. He was the first guy appointed by the Council of Constance to solve this great schism, right? He became the third pope. He ordered an investigation into Wycliffe's teachings in Bohemia. Something was going on over there. I mean, some guy named Wycliffe out of England was teaching the people of Bohemia of what they're supposed to believe. A new way of believing about the teachings of the church. I mean, we burned the guy and told everybody that he's a heretic, but he's still having influence in Bohemia. And so Alexander set about to have this investigated. And as part of that, he issued a decree that preaching could only be done in cathedrals, parish churches, and monasteries. The Chapel of Bethlehem did not qualify under this new edict to be a place of preaching. But Huss continued to preach there anyway. He said, I don't care. I don't care what the Pope says. And his preaching became even more radical. He began to teach and preach that an unworthy Pope is not to be obeyed. And by the way, I think he pretty much looked at John XXIII and his successors as being unworthy, okay, along with the popes in Avignon and in Rome before the Great Schism. He said and began to preach, like Wycliffe, that the Bible is the final authority by which the Pope is to rule and the people are to be judged. People are to be judged based on the traditions of the Church and what the Church teaches, but rather upon what the Bible teaches. And he realized that selling indulgences was evil. You remember I told you earlier that he had bought one, a plenary indulgence. But he had come to realize, even in the face of his own act, that the selling of indulgences is evil. And what particularly bothered him was the idea that selling indulgences means that you were selling the forgiveness of God. Because that's what an indulgence does, right? It gets you out of purgatory. It gets you forgiveness. And he found that to be utterly wrong. And in fact, he even went one step further. He says, if you're selling indulgences for the purpose of funding a crusade, you are committing a horrendous evil. But that is precisely what the popes were doing at the time. Now, let me just stop there for a second. Does that sound familiar? It should. Because, my friends, it is Luther who went to the chapel door in Wittenberg and nailed 95 theses to the door of why it is evil to sell indulgences. Huss is preaching that 100 years earlier. Okay, so you'll see where I'm at here. You have a man in the middle of the conciliar movement who is realizing that there are deep theological problems in the church. John the 23rd, you remember that little guy that was elected after Alexander V, who had to run off to Germany to protect himself? He excommunicated Hus. So Hus left Prague and began writing on the need for reformation. He left the church and began writing instead on the need of reformation. Now, when the Council of Constance was called in 1414, they invited him to come and help reform the church. They dangled a carrot in front of him and said, look, we need you to come and help us with this whole reform movement that we're trying to do. But John the 23rd used the council as a pretext to try him separately as a heretic. In other words, they invited him to come to the council, but it was a trick. And when he arrived, he was arrested. By the way, rumor has it, I don't know if this is true or not, but rumor has it that when John the 23rd fled from Sigismund in Germany in order to hide, the rumor is that he gave the keys to Hus's cell to Sigismund, the emperor, and instead of letting him go, Sigismund actually moved him to a more secure cell because he was afraid of him. Hus was brought in chains before the council in 1415, and he was ordered to recant his heresies. But when he was brought, he declared the following, quote, I appeal to Jesus Christ, the only judge who is almighty and completely just. In his hands I place my cause, since he will judge each, not on the basis of false witnesses and erring counsels, but on truth and justice. He was sent back to prison. Shortly thereafter, on July the 6th, 1415, he was taken to the cathedral. They dressed him in his priestly robes, and then they stripped him of those robes in public. They shaved his head in order to shave off his priestly adornment. You wore your hair in a certain way to indicate that you were a priest in that day. They shaved his head. They put a paper crown upon his head. They marched him past a great pyre of fire where his books were being burned, took him to the stake and burned him and killed him. His executioners threw his ashes into the lake so that nothing would remain of him. John Hus inspired, however, a great rebellion in Bohemia against the Pope and the Council. His followers, which came to be known as Hussites in various forms, developed something called the Four Articles, the basis of their resistance. The Word of God is to be preached freely. Communion is to be given in both kinds, meaning both the bread and the wine are to be given. At that time, only one was being given. The clergy should be deprived of all wealth, and public sin, like simony, was to be properly punished. Now, I put Hus and Wycliffe before you. You will notice how this goes. Wycliffe comes with new ideas of reformation. At the same time, a conciliation movement arises in Europe against the Pope and his unlimited authority. Those two things butt heads. Wycliffe dies before he really has a chance to push this, but his influence moves to Bohemia and picks up a man by the name of John Hus, who becomes, if you will, his follower, a Wycliffeite, if you will, that becomes the one to actually bring up these things in real ways, which caused tremendous problems in the conciliation movement, problems that needed to be eradicated by killing the very man who was bringing these Reformation issues up. So, what I want you to notice as we walk away from this time period is that in the period of time, roughly 100 years or so before Luther, you already have, in some parts of the world, England and Bohemia, and other places as well, but those two places in particular, you're already seeing the seeds of the Reformation beginning. You're already seeing the end of the medieval age and the beginning of the Reformation. That's why I called last week's lesson the end of the medieval age, because this is really the beginning of the Reformed Church. This is the beginning of the period of the Reformation. We like to link it to 1517, but I would push it to 1414. I would push it, or 1415. I would push it to the days of Huss and his martyrdom as when the Reformation really begins. Under the influence of men like Wycliffe, who begin to think differently about how the church ought to be, attempting to go back and bring back the true theological foundations of the church, ecclesiastically and doctrinally. They didn't get all the way to Bright. That's going to take a few more hundred years to accomplish, but they're beginning the process. And it's a good process that will go from this point. And you will notice, even now, the reaction of the institutional church. How is she going to react to men like Wycliffe and Huss and later Luther and Zwingli and Calvin and et cetera, Knox? How's the institutional church going to respond to that? And you know that there's going to be a great tug of war in all of this as men try to stand up and restore the church to what she's supposed to be. So what you have in this little period of time is what I consider to be the seeds of the Reformation. And a very important time. It would be nice if more of our people knew who Wycliffe and Huss really were. So I hope tonight I've given you an introduction to them in the hope that that may spark you reading a bit more about their lives to see how really important they are to us as Reformed people. Do you have any questions? They're well into the 17th century. Yeah. We're talking about the late 1600s. I mean, think about the founding of the Jamestown Colony, for example, in the 1600s. That's when you're talking about the Puritans. But their influence is coming out of here, absolutely. The Church of... I don't know. It's possible. I just didn't... There's so much more that could be read about Huss. I brought you a very short biography. It's possible there's more to it than that. You could very well be right. Yeah. My job tonight wasn't to try to get you all the fingers that would go out from Huss from this point. My job was just sort of introduce you to the man. It was really what I was trying to do.
This is not really a related thing, but how is that whole numbering system of John the 23rd and...
You followed in the footsteps of the man that you took the name from before. So if you took John, you went back and looked, okay, who was the last John? Okay, that was John the 22nd, so I'm going to be John the 23rd. So Benedict took the name.
So it's not a name that they were born with.
No. They're born with an actual name, and then they take a name to as their papal name. So Francis has an actual birth name. I don't even remember what it is. Ratzinger is the last name of Benedict the 16th. I do remember that. But most of them have Italian names that you can't pronounce anyways. Yeah, but the answer to your question, the official answer to your question is, when you decide to take a papal name, then you go back and look to see who the last guy was. And again, the Catholic Church keeps a succession, right? Because, and you go back and look.
John Paul, the 731st?
No, John Paul would be first because there was no previous pope named John Paul. So John Paul was the first guy to be named John Paul. In fact, he was the first pope to take a double name. So he took the name of his two predecessors, combined it into John Paul, so he became Pope John Paul.
He gets
to choose that, absolutely. When he's elected, he chooses that name. Correct. John Paul II took John Paul as the name because he took it in honor of the man that he followed, who only lived 33 days, and he was then known as John Paul II. When he took the name John Paul II, then John Paul became John Paul I. Today it's Francis, not Francis I. He will only be Francis I when there's a Francis II. If there's ever a Francis.
There's actually been 23 Johns.
Yeah. There's 16 Benedicts, 23 John. I think John is the most popular name amongst all the popes. Well, absolutely. That's actually right. That's actually right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Pope Paul VI was the pope during my formative years because in the Mass there's a little piece where you have this prayer time And the priest always mentions the Pope as a part of the prayer times. Pray for the Pope. Pray for Pope John. Pray for Pope Paul the VI. You know, so they would always have his name. And so whenever I hear Pope Paul the VI, it brings back memories of. Yes. Yes. It triggers me. Yes. It triggers me. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I first read this John the 23rd, I went, wait a minute. There was a 23rd. There was John the 23rd was when I was a kid. And so I went back and looked it up, and they don't recognize this John the 23rd because he didn't come from the Roman line. Any other questions? I don't know that. I've not, no. Oh, I'm not familiar with that quote. Okay. That might be apocryphal, because I've not read any of that in the histories that I read of Huss. So.